Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is August 22nd, 2013, and tonight, three main science topics I will be talking about. The comet that hit the sun this week, it's just humorous to watch the standard science community reacting to this as if, gee, just no big deal. I'll be talking about that and the factors involved. A second article coming out where scientists finally admit that they have no clue what causes lightning. Now, here's something. Something like 100 lightning strikes per second hit the Earth on an Earth-wide basis. And there is lightning all over the solar system. The ancients talk about the planets throwing lightning bolts back and forth. Remember Zeus throwing lightning bolts over to Mars and etc. And the electrical activity of comets. All of this denied. Nope, there ain't no electricity anywhere. Don't look at that lightning. Scientists don't know what causes it, but it must be cosmic rays. That's the latest theory, folks. Where do these people come from? Wow. Gives a new meaning to space science. Anyway, that's another story. I'll be talking about that. And then Comet Ison rediscovered. Amateur astronomers have now been picking up Comet Ison, and it's much smaller than expected or predicted by NASA's computer modeling. So the big whoopla over Comet Ison now is being downplayed. But its trajectory still will bring it by Mars in September, that being downplayed just like ho-hum, no big deal. And then the interaction with the sun, they're not talking at all about the interaction with Mercury. That's, but anyway, I'll be talking about that. Let me quick talk to the foreign audience. Okay, we have lots of people in foreign countries listening to this program. And you have to be, or you don't have to be, you can sit there in your armchair and not do anything. That's great. But I want to kind of coach you on how to be emissaries. If you've received benefit from my radio shows, from my books, from my other information or interviews on other radio programs. And by the way, I don't post anything on YouTube. So first of all, if there's anything on YouTube that resembles me or looks like me or sounds like me, I didn't put it there and I don't sponsor that. So YouTube is a no-no. YouTube is a giant pit of garbage. Let's put it that way. So how would a person in a foreign country promote Jim McCanny? First of all, don't preach. Don't go out, and if you're really excited about it, don't expect other people to be the same. So the way you somewhat do this is by actions, by being interested in something. Second of all, and this is constantly going on, people hear my name, get information about me, someone refers a friend giving my name. So they look up and they do a Google search on my name, and you get some good stuff, but a lot of bad stuff, a lot of bad publicity. Let's put it that way. I'm not exactly the most popular guy in standard science world. I don't take their money, and that's the key to most of their existence out there, scientists today. They need the federal money. They don't exist. They would be nothing if they didn't have that federal money coming in. So they literally bow and serve the money god, and the money god owns them and owns everything they do, and they're not going to say anything that would offend the money god. And so at any rate, that's pretty much the story of standard science. So I'm not exactly real popular because I have found and carved out my own path in the science world, and I'm living something like scientists may have lived 50 years ago, somehow finding benefit for their particular scientific work. And so the thing I do is educate the public and also help out with things like water. My most recent book is on water. Water, where did water come from on Earth? Water came from comets. Not little ice balls hitting Earth, and all that water would have been evaporated in a flash of a second and left Earth. And by the way, little ice balls don't even exist. Little ice balls don't have ice or snow or water on them. We've been to many comets, taken pictures, and there's not enough ice or water to put in an eyedropper bottle, let alone provide the Earth with oceans. What a ridiculous concept. But water does come from plasma discharge comets. My plasma discharge comet model talks about the tail material coming into the comet nucleus. And one might imagine, well, if water is coming into the comet nucleus, why don't we find any on the comet nucleus with small comets? Well, the reason is because when the material comes in, this is ionized water or other chemicals, hydrocarbons, hydrogen compounds like water, sulfur compounds like sulfur dioxide, why don't they stick to the nucleus? Well, some of them do because the electron beam coming in from the sunward side burns the chemicals and onto the surface of the comet nucleus. So you see this hydrocarbon tar burnt onto the comet nucleus. But what's happening with the water? Well, water in the environment of outer space is pressure of zero. Leaves almost immediately. The other thing that happens is you have an abundance of electrons in that area, so it neutralizes the ions that are coming in. The ions are positively ionized as they come into the nucleus. The electrons neutralize them, and then the solar wind grabs them and pushes them out. And that's why when scientists have put satellites out in the tail region of a comet, they see neutrals coming off the comet nucleus. They're called neutrals. And so it's a hydrogen, oxygen compounds or whatever, and they're just floating along out in space. And so the scientists assume that they're boiling off the comet nucleus, completely ignorant of the total complex process here in a plasma discharge comet model. The plasma discharge comet model is my coined phrase for my comet model that I developed, of course, back in the 1970s, and has explained literally everything that's going on in the solar system. But comet Ison right now is fizzling according to projected standards of NASA. And I started reporting, at first they had this comet of the century stuff, and then they start saying, oh, well, the nucleus is a couple kilometers across. And I'm going, wait a minute, hold it. You know, stop the music here, boys. They're not giving any information which would suggest that this comet, Comet Ison, is going to be the comet of the century. What on earth are they thinking about? And a typical comet, now here's the dichotomy. When the comet yesterday or 2 days ago hit the sun, they said, well, it was just a little comet and it disintegrated in the sun's environment and end of story. But Comet Ison is coming in and they're saying, well, it'll go around the sun, even though it's going to go right through the solar upper atmosphere, and it'll come out and become the biggest comet in history. Well, gee, which is it? Which side of the coin are you on, NASA? Standard astronomy, you know, they can't keep their story straight. And the reason they're saying that it would come out the other side is because Comet Lovejoy did. Comet Lovejoy was kind of a okay-sized comet, nothing grand, nothing gigantic. But the nucleus came out the other side, and you could see the nucleus in Soho. Soho Photos, this is the satellite that's watching the sun constantly. You can see the planets. You can see Venus. You can see Jupiter when it comes around behind the sun. You can see Mercury, little planet Mercury. And the object that was the nucleus of Comet Lovejoy was bigger than the planet Mercury. You could actually see it. Then it started to redevelop a tail. But anyway, just one of the some of the many, many dichotomies, erroneous interpretations, and fudge factoring that's being done in standard science. But at any rate, I'll talk more about that as the third scientific topic. But going back to foreign listeners, okay, what do you want to do to promote this message that you're hearing, your understanding? I would suggest let's talk about politics, the politics of science. I would suggest talking about the problem if you're in Europe or England or in most other countries of the world, or if you're in Latin America. Your lives are directly affected by the international banking cartel, which rules by economic terrorism. This past week, I've learned that more and more Latin American businesses are being taken over by international corporations. And so this is basically affecting the common person in these countries. It's going to affect people in middle income levels. You have to understand the structure of most Latin American countries. 90% of the people are dirt poor. Some countries have a fledgling middle class, and they are doing quite well with respect to that country. They're living in decent housing. They drive nice cars. They hang out at. They can go to a nice restaurant, and so they're doing okay. You know, they get some kind of a pension, possibly, if they work for the government. So they're not doing too bad. And then you have the ultra-rich, the very few people that got all the money. And those are the people who keep this whole cycle moving, because they're doing okay, and they cannot see beyond their own noses to understand what's limiting the economic progress of their country. They would all be much better if it were not for the government taking money out of their pockets and the banking community, which is loaning money to the governments and then the government paying back an interest and personal loans. Most people in these countries can't get ahead because they can't get capital money to make investments. They're hard workers. Very hard workers. You rarely find people in the United States working as hard as the people you find in Latin America. Workers, very hard workers, typically working long hours for low pay and under conditions that are very detrimental to their health. But these countries and the middle class would be much better off if these poor people could come up to some nominal level of income, because what would they do? They would spend it. And the businesses, the middle class businesses, would grow. But everything is kept down. So what is an essential part of this? Well, science is an essential part of this. Garbage science that is pawned off on the public is done worldwide. It's not just in the United States, but the United States is somewhat the leader. So, very simply, here's how you promote the message of Jim McCaney. You tell people that, hey, you know, there's something wrong here. And I think just about everybody, including the rich people, will agree with you that there's something wrong here. But what is it? What's the central core problem? And in that, you start to gain people's interest. When people look up my name, do a Google search or some other kind of search, and you come up with all kinds of negative comments about Jim McCaney, look at the source. Look at who's talking. Who's putting out that information? Well, you can connect these people back to the I always say, who butters their bread? Who's providing the money for these people to live the life they live? And in therein, you see that these people are, you know, they're making their living off of providing basically false scientific information, promoting the NASA party line, and a lot of them do it because they believe in it. Well, that's great, but you see who they are. They're not high-ranking professional scientists. They're little minions. They're little wannabes that never made it in the scientific community. So they basically run chat pages or the equivalent of a blog and get money passed to them so life is good. So they think they're doing a good service, but what they, you know, they're people that left their brain on the shelf 20 years ago. Anyway, that's a complex world. So you have to convince people that, for example, the comet model, or my model of how the solar system works, all of these things are central to the issue, but there's a much bigger view of the world that you have to take. You have to understand why bad science and astronomy are being passed off to the public. Why is it so important for the world leaders, the bankers, who control by economic terrorism, why is it important for them to keep the public stupid about science? These are some of the issues. Then when you realize this and you start to read through the lines, between the lines of what comes around in the newspapers, the majority of people in the world don't even understand what a dirty snowball comet model is. That's how bad off they are. And so if they ever do get to become curious, the standard line they would learn in a school or a standard astronomy class, if they happen to take one in a school or university level classes, is complete garbage. And most of them would forget most of that the day they walked out the door. The level of scientific knowledge in the world today is absolutely horrifically pathetic. The United States, I was talking just the other day with, I got a call from Pastor Butch Paul. And we were talking about what is the problem in the world. What are the basic problems? And we came to the conclusion, both of us independently, that the average guy out there working is the problem. Why? Because they're trying to make a living. They don't understand that one day, very soon possibly, they could be out of a job, be out of their house, their family has no place to go, but they're just struggling, and all they can see is just 1 inch in front of their nose. Nothing more. So they just keep going, they keep grinding it out. They vote for presidents. That doesn't matter who you vote for, because both parties are working for the same central banking system and completely bought and paid for. These are the central problems. The people who have fallen through the cracks from this system have no voice. You never hear from them. So the people in the world out there in foreign countries, they have to realize that in the United States, there's the pecking level here, and there's a lot of people in the United States, more and more each day, who have fallen through the cracks and are simply economically devastated. They have no ability to speak, they have no ability to regain economic stature, but the people in foreign countries are really far down the line when it comes, because most business really comes from the United States, even though we're a failing country, we're going down in economic prowess. Still, the United States is kind of the central business block of the world. Most trade, etc., comes through here, a lot through China, a lot through Russia, but most countries, their biggest source of income is trade with the United States. So understand then that if you're in a foreign country, I don't care if it's France or Uganda or Taiwan or you know, Southeast Asia, the Philippines, your Latin American country, whatever foreign country you're dealing with, you are in a pecking order with the United States, and you come very much last if you're a citizen there, and your governments are very much manipulated, bought, and paid for by the United States' powerful economic engine and government and policies. So at any rate, that's the kind of thing you got to talk to people about. Not simply, hey, there's a comet model. that's important too. But people have to understand the whole picture. The whole picture. And then they can understand why bad science is being pawned off. But in most countries, since they don't even know what the bad science is, it gives them an opportunity to learn about real science from my books, from my DVDs, etc. And now my books and DVDs are in e-format, so it makes it much easier for people in foreign countries to obtain my books and read them. A couple of them are even available in Spanish. So, but most people who are educated can read in English, and a lot of professors, and that's another thing. If you're taking classes, if you know somebody in a university or a high school, make arrangements to get my books, my e-books. They can get them overnight. They can start reading them, and it starts opening up a whole new world for these people. So I would say the biggest thing you can do is promote the e-books. In the next day, they have them. They're reading them and getting an education that you're not going to find any place else. Okay, so enough of that. That was addressed not only to foreign people, but people in this country. Let my books and information do the talking for you. Just encourage people to first ignore the negative commentary that's on the internet when you look up my name. And if they say, well, look at all this this bad information, say, well, just tell them, well, why do you think that's there? Why do you think the government is spending so much time, money, and effort trying to badmouth this guy? That wouldn't be there if I was not successful. The fact that it's there is telling you that I'm successful, that I'm reaching the public, and somebody's putting a lot of effort into trying to destroy my name and work. Well, that should tell you something right there. That's actually positive advertising for me, because that tells you that I'm succeeding, that I have a message that they don't want you to hear, and that's a good way to turn that around, so to speak. Okay, so on to the scientific topics. I just want to remind you that, by the way, and this is somewhat surprised me, a short while ago, I offered bulk pricing on water filter elements. The dome filters, all of these you can buy 10 at a time now at a reduced cost, at a pretty good savings. So the dome filters, which have twice the capacity of the standard 7-inch candle, by the way, the domes do not work in stainless steel containers. They only work in plastic, the plastic containers. They'll work in any of the plastic housings. So at any rate, the dome filters, but they have twice the capacity of a 7-inch filter element. So if you have any of the plastic filter canisters, then the domes will work fine for you. Then I've got 10 at a time, the standard 7-inch candle. 10 at a time, the add-on fluoride arsenic add-on filters, and then also the new filter. It's a 7-inch candle, the same format as the old 7-inch candle, but it has the fluoride arsenic removal filtration right in the 7-inch candle, and that's been fairly popular. People have asked me, well, what's better? Is it better to have the old 7-inch candle with the canister down below, the add-on filter, or this new one? And I checked into this, and dollar for dollar, you get about the same amount of filtration. It's just a matter of preference. And so at any rate, both are good. I notice some people are buying like two at a time and then trying them out. You can also get all of these two at a time. But the response has been pretty favorable with 10 at a time. Because people can buy them, they want to store up a bunch of these, buy ahead in case of troubled times, some bad times coming down the road. They're gonna have their water filter elements stored up, so they have years and years worth of filtration capacity. And by the way, all of the filters, the domes, the standard 7-inch ceramic candles, and the new 7-inch ceramic candle with the arsenic fluoride removal in it, all of these can be cleaned off on the surface. You just clean them, scrape it with a butter knife, or rub a plastic pad, not using soap, and you scrape off the outside gunk layer that builds up on the outside of the filter, and you get back down to white ceramic, and you can do this many, many times. The limitation on most of these is the charcoal in the middle, or if it's an arsenic fluoride filtration in the candle, that has a limitation. And so you will have less and less ability to filter those problem items out of water if you continue to clean your filter elements. But I always take my old filter elements that I've used for a long time, I let them dry out good, and then I put them in, just mark them used. In case of emergency, some days, it's like some poor people, they kept some old shoes, and all of a sudden the old shoes are their good shoes. You don't know what kind of times we've got coming down the road here. So at any rate, enough of that, but go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, that's seven letters, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, and check these out, all the books, the DVDs, etc. Okay, enough of that. Just go to the webpage, all the information is there. But I just wanted to note that people are responding positively to the concept of 10 at a time filter elements that are now available on the webpage. Okay, so just one other quick afterthought to people in foreign countries or in the United States, if you're trying to promote my work, warn people about the vast amount of misinformation on the internet. It's just a zoo out there. And so a lot of people get to my page and they start getting real answers, and that's where they concentrate their time. Just avoid YouTube, avoid the internet. There's a lot of really amazingly bad information out there. There's a lot of nutcases who don't have a clue what they're talking about. They try and copy my work or sound like me or something like that. And then a lot of these people are actually supported by NASA under the table because they want nutcases. They want as many nutcases all over the internet as possible. That's their goal. If those people didn't exist, they'd have to create them. So a good old nutcase is a real good investment for the NASA misinformation machine that wants to control both sides. They want to make the electrical part of the universe the craziest thing that you ever heard of, and then people won't listen to it. Well, anyway, okay, enough of that. The comet hitting the sun this week. It's not such a small comet. I get a kick out of the spaceweather.com and the other mouthpieces, the Naval Observatory, Carl Batten's. Are these people really this stupid? And the answer is, yeah, they are. But they're defending the party line. Their entire existence relies on the fact that they have to promote the party line. But there's a picture, it's available on the internet, to see this comet coming in from the south, comes in, and before it hits the sun just explodes. The entire surface of the sun is exploding, a coronal mass ejection it's called. And the excuse, which has always been used by standard science, is, well, the comet hadn't hit the sun yet, and so it couldn't have been caused by the comet. Well, that's the whole point. The whole point is the comet is a plasma discharge comet. It's interacting electrically with the sun. So yes, just like a spark plug, it's not exactly at the sun yet physically, but it's creating that discharge that sparks the sun. The whole surface of the sun is exploding as this comet approaches. And so no, the comet does not wait, or the process of the CME does not wait until the comet hits the sun. And so right there, they're pawning off misinformation, bad science, and if it were a little 2 meter across snowball, certainly you would not expect this to have any effect on the sun whatsoever. And so they're pawning off misinformation, the science is absurd, and they have the head in the sand approach that they simply will not look or allow to be published any information about me or my comet work. We have hundreds and hundreds of examples where comets come in, the sun is just sitting there doing its thing, kind of tranquil. A comet comes in, when it gets close to the sun, boom, there goes a big solar flare. Or in the, we have one which is on the cover of my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. The two comets came in, one following the other one. The one barely misses this kind of a spike solar flare that's occurring. The one comet just barely misses, and the second one goes right through it. And you see the discharge coming down that spike coming off the sun. The comet interacts with that spike, and boom, out of that location in the sun comes one of the biggest solar flares ever recorded. And, of course, standard science goes, oh, just happenstance, just a random event, unrelated. And so this has been the standard line. So this continues to go on. This continues to happen where the... Okay, so just quickly, how does a comet, a little comet coming in close to the sun, spark a massive explosion on the solar surface? First of all, you have to understand that the sun's fusion is at the surface. This is number one, numero uno, error in standard science. For a long time, for 100 years, they have imagined that the solar furnace is at the core of the sun. Everything about the sun does not match this model. The core of the sun is what they say, the fusion of the sun is at the core. And it, with that model, you would expect the surface of the sun to be a nice, even, glowing ball at around 5,700 degrees, and that's what it is. Calculating backwards, they could estimate the amount of energy coming out of the central core. But all of this surface activity, the magnetic arcs that come out of the sun, all of the activity that you see would not be there. There's simply no mechanism for a central core fusion model to create all of this activity. The solar wind, all of the electrical activity in the solar system, or electric comets interacting with the surface of the sun. None of this should be possible. So, at any rate, first of all, the core fusion model of the sun is wrong. The correct response is that the fusion of the sun is up in the surface. The hydrogen in deuterium, etc., in the surface layers of the sun, in the atmosphere, are in a fusion fire. Just like Jupiter is a small star, it has a certain level of fusion in its atmosphere. Saturn also. And they have very similar atmospheric composition as the sun. And they have a proton wind coming off them. These have been measured, directly observed, just like the sun. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing is that this creates a capacitor out to beyond the orbit of Pluto. That's what the comet nuclei are discharging when they come into the solar system. They start to discharge way out there, but it doesn't become apparent, it doesn't become significant until they get in probably around the orbit of Jupiter. However, the biggest comets in history have been seen beyond the orbit of Saturn. Okay. So the end result is that a comet is discharging the solar capacitor. The tail we see is the material being drawn into the negatively charged nucleus, and I'm not going to go into all of the details of how this works. That's presented in my books. You have to go and read this. It's a lot of detail. But the end result is that it's like a electrical discharge radially outward from the sun with the comet nucleus at the center. of this discharge. The comet nucleus is the thing causing the discharge as it moves through the electric field of the sun. So when it gets near the sun, the physical size of the nucleus, which is what standard science likes to refer to, they say, oh, a couple meters across. And by the way, they've never measured that. That's just a pie in the sky, pull a number out of the rabbit's hat number. It has absolutely nothing to do with a measurement. But the electrical size of that comet extends for possibly hundreds of thousands of miles, sometimes up to millions of miles, or in the case of larger comets, 100 million miles. Effects from comets have been measured extremely at extreme distances from comets. So how can a little snowball that's a couple meters across cause these effects that are actually measured? Or how could it affect the sun from a distance of 100,000 miles or a quarter of a million miles away? Well, that's because the electrical size of the comet is very big. And since you can't see that in standard science, the Tier 2 scientists never have data when they're talking about these things. They're just talking off the top of their head. They're just giving you the standard storybook story that they learned in college, so that must be right, right? But the real answer is that the electrical size of the comet is large. So that's why the comet nucleus is not at the sun when it kicks off that CME. It's interacting electrically with the sun. The energy that's passing down through that discharge comes back to the sun, ignites fusion at the solar surface much more than normal, and boom! In the case of the comet two days ago, an entire CME, an entire surface of the sun explodes and goes out into outer space from the sun. So this is caused by the comet. The comet is not just a little rock a couple meters across or whatever. And to imagine, by the way, you can see this comet. It's a fairly significant comet compared to the size of the sun. To imagine its nucleus is 2 meters across and cause this tail is absurd. So once again, as I've always said, one of the biggest lies within NASA, within the Naval Observatory, if that's who's defending the party line, the biggest lie is the size of nuclei of comets. And they can measure them directly. They can measure them down to the inch with radio telescopes. But they never do that. They never publish the kind of real test results, the real measurement results that exist. Somebody's out there taking these results, but they're not doing that. They're letting these little Tier 2 puppets out here go, oh, it's two meters across, or believed to be. Well, who believes that? Nobody I know. You see, okay, so this is the dichotomy between reality and what's being reported to the public. Okay, so that's a great example. These come along every now and then. But this is one of the better examples of a comet causing interaction with the sun. Now, just an added issue, because of my work and because of the awareness of this, you have lots of little puppets running around the internet, jumping up and down, making claims and trying to do copycat work. And a lot of this, like I said, is being promoted by the government, because they want to make it sound goofy as can be. They don't want to refer you to Jim McCanney's webpage to get the information. They want some YouTube video with some guy with space music going on that says, woo, we're all going to die. You know, and that's the kind of thing that they support. So that diffuses the real message. It provides flack. Flak is a lot of shrapnel that fills the air. You can't tell one over here from the other one. It just fills the air. So that's what YouTube videos do. It fills the air with complete garbage so that nobody can pick out the real story. That's what's going on. Okay, so I hope that clarifies, and this is real good because, number one, you get to learn the real science. Number two, because you can see the amount of misinformation being pawned off on the public, the amount of effort, the amount of time, and the high-level agencies, spaceweather.com, other new scientists, so the article I'm just going to talk about now about lightning, these are what you would consider reliable sources in the scientific community. But these are the mouthpieces of Tier 2 science. And on first examination, they don't make sense. The other article that came out this past week, I'm just pulling this up right now. Okay, I've got this article here. It is from, it's a New Scientist. It's reprinted in some other magazine online, but I'm not going to talk about that. It's just, so the original source is New Scientist, an article from New Scientist. Looks like posted Sunday, August 18th. The title, it says, "We don't actually know what triggers lightning strikes." And as most titles, it is kind of a misinformation right in the title. Because when you read the article, they don't know what even causes lightning, let alone what triggers lightning. What causes the electrical energy somewhere in the cloud system that would cause lightning. Now, I talk about lightning all the time. So first, this time, I'll give you the correct answer. And I want to preface this by saying, a cloud, if it were a battery system, an energy source in itself, how would it throw lightning out of the cloud? Now, we have the ground where lightning strikes, and we also have lightning which shoots up above the clouds. How would lightning, electrical energy, come out of the source of electricity? Let's be the devil's advocate and say that clouds generate electricity, which they don't. And in this article, you'll see that they've actually made measurements. They've gone up in the clouds, they've made measurements, and they're going, hey, there's no electricity here, folks. Ain't no electricity in clouds. How come electricity comes shooting out of clouds? But at any rate, let's pretend that clouds did create electricity. Well, the end result is that they would try and discharge within each other. It's just a cloud, it's just air. There's no reason for that electrical energy to try and find a path somewhere else. And it can't create a differential charge with respect to other places, because what would it do with that charge? You know, it's a battery. If you take a 1.5-volt battery, like you put in your flashlight or in your radio, take a battery like that, and let's crank it up to 1,000,000 volts, okay? Is lightning going to come shooting out the sides of that little battery? No. No, because the lightning is going to try and discharge internally the most direct path for the electrical energy to move in that battery is internal. There's no reason for it to shoot out of the terminals unless you put a low resistance wire or a low resistance circuit across the terminals. Now electricity can flow, okay, but it's outside the path of that battery, and you have put something there to allow the electricity to flow, but it only flows back to the source, the battery. It doesn't flow off to some other place. If you held your battery up to an electrical socket, okay, there's a vast network of electrical wiring and wiring that goes out of your house, etc. But the battery will never, in 1,000,000 years, discharge off to the wires if you hold it close. Why would it do that? Well, it's not in the cards. It's not what electricity does. Electricity searches the easiest path. So, now, let's go back. I was playing devil's advocate, saying, what if clouds created electricity internally? But in this article of where they're saying they don't really know what triggers lightning from clouds, the scientists actually talk about the measurement of electric fields in clouds. Okay, so I'm going to read from the article here. It opens up by saying, subtitle, we don't even know what we don't know about lightning. It says the main problem, now I'm reading from this article, it says the main problem is that we don't know how a thundercloud gets the spark needed to initiate a lightning bolt. And now here's the good part. The biggest mystery is that the electric field in thunderclouds is not very large. Years of experimental measurements from airplanes and air balloons have shown that the field is about 10 times smaller than what is needed to initiate lightning. It is not clear how a lightning bolt is born, but the idea is that something has to seed it first. Okay, so thunderclouds, by a factor of 10, do not have enough electrical charge in them to perform, in other words, to generate lightning. The lightning to ground, we know what the electrical potential is. We know the amount of electricity in lightning. It heats up air to an immense temperature, and a huge, huge amount of energy passes between the cloud and ground. Yet, scientists go into clouds that are in a thunderstorm system. There's no electric field to speak of. So how exactly does this cloud generate electricity? Well, it doesn't. And the simple answer is it's part of a bigger electric field. And where does that electric field come from? Well, you would say, well, it comes from the atmosphere above and below the cloud. But there again, if there were just an electric field there, it would soon dissipate and go away, and there's nothing to continually drive it. So once you had a couple lightning bolts, that'd be the end of the story, because all the energy would be dissipated. So that's not the answer. Where do you look for this energy that's creating this overall electric field and electrical discharges that we call lightning? Well, the theory that comes out of this article is that it's cosmic rays. Now, a cosmic ray is a high-energy proton. They're coming at us from all directions in outer space, but they're a single proton. And they come from not only from other stars, they are now known to come from our very own star, the Sun. But they're not always there. They're not always occurring. Cosmic rays are not always there in abundance, or they might be coming on the far side of the Earth and the lightning's on the other side of the Earth. They're not always there when lightning is going on. There's 100 lightning strikes per second all around the Earth continually. A big storm system will produce 10,000, 20,000 lightning strikes as it passes over a state. And so, you know, where's this electricity coming from? It's certainly not coming from the clouds. So please, Tier 2 scientists, you know, understand that if you're looking at cosmic rays to trigger lightning in clouds, you first have to show that the clouds even have enough energy to get triggered. You know, it'd be like having a gun with no bullets. You can pull the trigger all you want, but there ain't no bullets in the gun. And that's what we're talking about here. This is rock stupid science. These scientists are looking for a nugget. Anything that, and I can't believe these people are this stupid, but they are promoting this idea that cosmic rays trigger lightning. But as I said, how can it trigger lightning when the source you're looking at, the clouds, have no energy to produce lightning? So at any rate, but that's Tier 2 science at its best. What's going on? Well, as I said before, the same issue as with comets. Comets are discharging the solar capacitor. The Earth acts like a comet all the time. We have a comet tail. It's commonly mistermed a magnetic tail, but it's basically our electrical discharge in the solar capacitor. It's much less than a comet would have, because we're in a nice circular orbit around the Sun. And by the way, August, we are in the middle of the August return current sheet, which this year is really kind of weak. It's really, the whole solar system in general is very weak. And by the way, that's another kind of side issue with this solar flare from the sun as the comet came in, I was just talking about, because the sun has been doing nothing. We have not had a real good CME in ages, ages and ages. So this little comet coming in, boom, the sun takes off, sends out a big CME at the same time in coordination with the comet coming in. And so, that's just happenstance. The sun has not been performing, so it's really a stretch of the imagination to think that this is not related in some manner with that comet coming in. Okay, back to lightning. So what causes lightning? As Earth discharges the solar capacitor, other conditions in outer space, our magnetic field, compress, electrons, when they come from the sun, electrons and protons split. Electrons go one way in our magnetic field, protons go the other way, and this causes an EMP. It causes an electrical voltage across planet Earth, way out in space. So when, say, a solar flare comes or other solar conditions, this compresses that. That compresses our ionosphere. This is one of the main causes of low pressure cells. We have comet-like extensions coming out of the upper ionosphere. Water can come in and drop down into snow, into thunderstorm systems, causing water to influx into those systems, and electrical discharges. The overall electrical discharge from outer space is then going all the way down through the clouds. So what does the cloud do? What's the importance of the cloud? Well, the cloud is like an extension of it's like a finger pointing up in a sense, and it bridges the gap between ground and the electric field above. Let's take an example. Let's look at the backyard bug killer. It's called a zapper. It's got a fluorescent light in the middle. It's got a set of high voltage plates in there, or a screen, and then the outside is another screen that's at ground potential so you don't touch it and kill yourself. But anyway, the bug flies in, and the electrical plate flies in, and he's coming in at ground potential. As he flies in towards the higher potential plate, it creates a discharge. That discharge always occurs where the bug is. And zap, it burns the bug, and the bug falls down dead, and that's how it works. Well, the solar system is much the same. And so when the cloud, for example, is there, it's kind of like the bug in between the plates. It's where the electrical discharging occurs. That's why clouds cause lightning. It's not because of some internal generation process within a cloud, and even if that did happen, lightning wouldn't come shooting out the top and bottom of the clouds. That's all of the standard science. You can see how backwards standard science is. And then the end result is they publish an article a couple of days ago in New Scientist magazine basically saying, we don't know what causes lightning. Well, how can you know what causes lightning if your head is in the sand or somewhere else? It's impossible. But that's what's being pawned off on the poor, unsuspecting public. So anyway, the real story is that we are part of the overall solar system electrical circuit. Our atmosphere is involved in that. And when cloud activity occurs, in fact, clouds would not even form if it were not for the vertical electric field of Earth between ground and the ionosphere. Then up high in the above the troposphere, the weather system sphere of Earth, we have what we call the jet streams. They are bands of electrical current. The northern jet stream snakes up north and south and winds easterly, and the southern hemisphere jet stream does the same thing. It winds and snakes but moves generally in an easterly direction. The equatorial jet stream rotates in a westerly direction. It goes west, and that's what carries the hurricanes and the on the tropical storm systems that occur around the equatorial region of the Earth. These drive the lower layer weather systems. All of this is electrically. They are coupled with the geomagnetic field of the Earth. That's why in the northern and the southern hemisphere, the jet streams are positive ions. Moving in an easterly direction, the equatorial jet stream is primarily electrons. Moving in the westerly directions, those couple to create our magnetic field along with the geomagnetic field, and much of our geomagnetic field is related to the Van Allen belts and another layer of magnetic, the geomagnetic field that is out in outer space, the plasma magnetic field. All of these are coupled. Back in when I published my weather book, I gave a five-layer plan for the magnetosphere of Earth. All of this is electrical except for a small component, which is in the core of the Earth in the form of magnetic fields in nickel and primarily iron, deep in the core of the Earth. And some of it not so deep in the core of the Earth. A lot of the iron is up closer towards the surface. So at any rate, just quickly turning a one-minute update, Comet Ison has been rediscovered. It's much fainter than the original predictions. I'm expecting it to still cause some excitement in the astronomy world with its interaction with Mars around starting mid-September, having some interactions as it goes by Mars October 1st. Then later on, it'll be coming in the backside of the planet Mercury right before it plunges into the Sun in November. So keep tuned. I'll be giving dates and times and places to watch for all of this. And as we head into that, very interesting times. So I would love to see, and this has not happened yet, but I would love to see a planet like the planet Mercury go comet, actually develop into a comet. And we know a lot about Mercury. We know there's no water on the surface. So for Mercury to develop into a comet would be absolutely beyond fantastic. And it could happen this fall. And, of course, nobody's talking about that except me on this show. I'll keep you posted times, dates, where to look. Once again, visit the webpage, jmccsci.com. And all the water filter products, things that you won't find anyplace else, the pre-filter, the modular filtration and storage system, all of the other stainless steel and plastic water filter systems, all of the filter elements, my books, DVDs, CDs, and a lot of information there. I don't have time to talk about all of that here, but visit the webpage and the secure web ordering page. And once again, www.jmcc, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.